Well, as people arrive, we'll just sit quietly for a few minutes and just arrive into ourselves, into our bodies and our minds and our hearts, knowing that people will come in over the next 10 or 15 minutes, but we'll begin with a short arriving meditation. And in this time of arriving, using this as a real welcoming of yourself into practice, welcoming of yourself in the company of others who are also welcoming themselves. Sensing into your body. Sense of sitting just as you are. Feeling the places the body is making contact with whatever you're sitting on. Allowing the mind to drop into the body in a restful way. Just as the body rests on the chair or the cushion, the mind rests on the breath and on the body. Inviting each inhale to be an arriving and each exhale a settling. Inviting the heart to join, inviting the mind to join. Right into this moment of this time together. Good morning, everybody. I love arriving meditation. Just the pause, the transition from just getting here, kicking our shoes off, getting settled. Are you warm? Does it feel warm in here? Yeah. Some are comfortable. Some are hot. I'm hot. So for those of you I haven't met, my name is Heidi Born. And I have the great honor of teaching here for Sylvia Boorstein and Donald Rothberg when they can't be here. And it's just such a pleasure. I live in Arcata, which is about 300 miles north of here. So I don't get to come that often, but I do listen to the class as it's recorded each week, so I get to feel a part of our Wednesday Sangha, and it's a privilege to be here. So thank you for coming. Is there anybody here who has not been to Spirit Rock before? Well, welcome, welcome. I'm really glad you're here, and I wonder if you would be willing to stand up, maybe say your name, and say hello. Would that? Okay. Thank you for coming. What inspired you to come, Isabella?
My sister.
Great. Good. Welcome. Wow, great. What brings you, Nicole?
I'm here for a work trip, so.
Well, I'm honored. Thank you for carving out the time for us. Welcome. How long will you be in town? Great. Good. Well, it's a little warmer here.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. And you? Very nice. Thank you so much. I'm really happy you're here. Good. Thank you. Well, great. Thank you, Sarah. Good. Anybody else? Did I miss? It's always so heartwarming when people come back. If you've been here before and you've come again. And also it's so lovely to have people who haven't been here before to come. So thank you very much. The way our morning will work is that I'll say a few words now, and then we'll have a meditation. And after the meditation, we will have a break. We'll have some announcements during that time. And then we'll talk with each other. I'll offer some Dharma thoughts. Are there any questions? All right. Well, thank you for being here. So one of the regular occurrences that happens in this group that I think is very lovely is that we start out our morning together introducing ourselves to one another in a little bit of an expanded way beyond, you know, who's new, but actually talk with each other for a few minutes. And I like to give us a little bit of a topic for that. And I mean, it's wonderful to turn to the person next to you or to get up across and go across the room and meet somebody whom you've never spoken with before. But one of my favorite questions sounds a little bit archaic and antiquated. It comes from, I believe it's from Ralph Waldo Emerson. And the story goes that when he would see friends he hadn't seen for a long time, the question would be, what has become clear to you since last we met? So we can change that to, what have you learned lately? Or what has surprised you this year? Just something that has come up. Has there been something that you have learned that has actually maybe created a pivot point for you in your life? Something that's changed because you became aware of something or some clarification happened. So let's just pause and go inside for a couple minutes and reflect on that. You don't have to search too deeply. Anything from, you know, maybe since the last time you were here, or just something that comes to mind. Okay. So let's come back and find another person to talk with and introduce yourself, say your name. It can be somebody you know or somebody you don't know, and share what this awareness is. Put your hand up if you need a partner. Here we go. Let's put it together. It looks like this is pretty fun. Oh, you didn't switch yet? Really fast. We're going to start to come back, and if you didn't switch, you can keep the conversation going at the break. So I'd like you to just sense into your body and your heart and mind, how did that feel? So how do you feel? Somebody just say, how was that? Did you enjoy it? Where was that? It was lovely. Yeah. Can you feel a little bit enlivened? The energy up a little bit? Yes.
I like it because I get more value out of the Sangha experience.
Exactly. And we're going to talk today on refuge in the Dharma and refuge in the Sangha. And what it means, what it feels like, what it actually is, how we experience that. And it's also very sweet to know a little bit about others who are here, about what we've learned lately, or whatever the question might be that we explore. And we get to share about who we are when we do that. And, you know, the question that says that, you know, we can be in a social situation and people say, what do you do? Anybody object to that question? Right? So it doesn't get to the heart of what makes you tick or what is important to you. You know, there's a great story about that from John Lennon, and apparently when he was 8 years old, the teacher said the assignment was, what do you want to be when you grow up? And he said, happy. And she said, you don't understand the question. And he said, no, you don't understand life. So isn't that what we all want? And so when we come in here and we share something about our what makes us tick, what's important to us, what we've learned, what we love, what lifts us up, we get a real connection with each other. And that's the other thing that we all know, whether we know it consciously or not, that what is important is to connect with one another in an authentic way. And so when we share, what have I learned lately? That's a big question. So is there anybody who would like to share something that you learned lately that's been powerful for you? And no pressure. Seriously, no pressure. Yes, please tell me your name. Erica. Exactly. Yeah. I mean, what are the different ways we can language what makes you tick? You know, what's really fun for you? Somebody said recently to somebody I know, what do you do for fun? And she was stumped. And realized, I need to put some fun in my life. Because we can be so caught up in our work, you know, in our day-to-day, and we don't necessarily equate that with fun. But it's true. We need to have these light-hearted times also. So it's fun. I'm really glad that we did that. Thank you for doing that. And the other reason I really enjoy bringing in a question that we are all exploring together is that it really brings us right into the heart of mindfulness. Because mindfulness is the opportunity to become present. That's one way to think about it. That's a very short definition, but it's true. And so when we bring our curiosity to something we're thinking about, that is mindfulness. Mindfulness is the awareness of whatever is happening right now with a kind heart, with this openness. So I wonder if in your conversations, whether you switched partners or just had it as a conversation, did it pique your curiosity to listen to the other person? My hunch is, yeah, that was probably fun because it took the emphasis off of us. And sometimes for some of us, we really like having the emphasis not be on us. It can be uncomfortable. And we can be much more comfortable opening and listening to who is this other person. And that requires kindness. That requires mindfulness. So every single time you get curious about another person or something or an experience, that is cultivating mindful awareness. So I'm glad you like doing that. I like doing it a lot too. I think it's a lot of fun. So I'll just share with you something about me, about what has become clear to me in the last number of months, which is that I want to have more fun. And so I've taken up stand-up paddleboarding. It's really fun. And it gets me outside, which I love. I love outdoor recreation. But you know, the other thing that I really realized that I need to do is I need to stop having my eyes at things that are this distance, whether it's a device, whether it's the computer, whether it's a book, whether it's writing. So often this is what we're doing, right? We've got this whatever 12-inch distance from our eyes that we are engaging. And I was starting to feel like I needed horizon eyes Like I could literally feel it in the muscles of my eyes that I needed to get further out. So that's another point of awareness, of discovery, of curiosity about how our habits really do have so many ripple effects on what we do. So just drop that into your own awareness of what, giving yourself permission to say, huh, what is happening here? What isn't happening here? What other part of me am I not tapping into? Because we're so habitual. So it's really fun to tap into another part of ourselves to have creative expression or just some other way to express what is important to us. So when these awarenesses come up about what have I learned lately or what has been clear, what has become clear, and if you get that message that says, huh, there's some avenue I need to explore, do it if you can. And it doesn't have to be this huge thing. You don't have to go travel around the world. It can be that you put your device down for 2 hours a day and just go look outside and just expand the view. All right, let's sit. How about we have our morning meditation? Once again, settling in, finding a relaxed and comfortable posture. As Jack Kornfield reminds us, right here between heaven and earth, find your spot. Sensing the feet touching the ground, if they are. Whole body making contact with whatever you're sitting on and turning the awareness inward, welcoming yourself. Sensing down into the breath, noticing the gentle movements of the body with each breath cycle. Just noticing. It's helpful for you to set an intention for your practice. Do that. It doesn't have to be extraordinary. It can be quite simple. I listen well to my own voice. May I sense the breath. May I come back gently when the mind wanders. Anything like that. From Gavin Harrison. Awareness meditation is a way of opening our attention to the truth of what is present. We do not selectively pay attention to pleasant things and ignore the unpleasant. We open choicelessly to what is positive and joyous as much as to the suffering that we find. Meeting each moment without resistance, we discover unsuspected beauty in our hearts, minds, and bodies, and in the world around us. We sense the uniqueness of each fleeting breath. We perceive the movement of nature within us. We feel sad without needing to justify or eliminate the emotion. And we feel happy without needing to believe that we will never again know sadness. This is the way of meditation. from wherever you are, sensing back into the body and into the breath. Sensing into this quality of being here, quality of presence. Body and in the mind. And now turning particularly to the presence of your own heart. How is the heart today? Allowing it to be as it is. Perhaps even imagining breathing in and out of the heart space, however you sense it. Each breath in from all directions fills the heart with fresh air. Each breath out, back out into all directions, allows the heart to soften and expand, become a little more spacious, to soften the parts that may feel a little rigid. Taking a few breath cycles like this, the heart's breath. And we'll move into our time of the sharing of goodwill, offering out loud those we may be thinking of. I'm thinking of all of those human and non-human who are struggling with the loss of habitat, how we can all find our way within that. It's a poem called Small Kindnesses from Danusha Lamaris. I've been thinking about the way when you walk down a crowded aisle, people pull in their legs to let you by, or how strangers still say, bless you, when someone sneezes, a leftover from the bubonic plague. Don't die, we're saying. And sometimes when you spill lemons from your grocery bag, someone else will help you pick them up. Mostly, we don't want to harm each other. We want to be handed our cup of coffee hot and to say thank you to the person handing it, to smile at them and for them to smile back, for the waitress to call us honey when she sets down the bowl of clam chowder, and for the driver in the red pickup truck to let us pass. We have so little of each other now, so far from tribe and fire, only these brief moments of exchange. What if they are the true dwelling of the holy, these fleeting temples we make together when we say, here, have my seat. Go ahead, you first. I like your hat. Notice for a moment just how that feels right now, to have sat for a little bit, to have heard from one another and how we hold each other's hearts in this sangha together. Just notice how that feels. Perhaps some comfort in knowing that we're not alone. We're here together. So, couple of announcements. We'll take 10 minutes now for a break. On the back table is some information on what I'm up to, if a couple of things, if you'd like to look at that. And one more thing, there is a handout for the next part of our morning together. So when you come back in, they'll be back there somewhere. John, do you know? Okay, there'll be a chair with handouts on there. So just grab one when you come in. All right, take about 8 minutes or so to be specific. Okay, let's come back. There are handouts in the back on a chair. So don't get too wrapped up in the handout yet. I know it's intriguing, but I had to figure out the right time to distribute it. We'll get there. Okay, well, welcome back. Thank you for coming back. You didn't leave. Yeah. The last time I was here was about 5 or 6 weeks ago, and we met out in the meadow, which was very sweet because the building was being restained on the outside. And we had a really lovely conversation about what it means to take refuge in the Buddha. And I've been practicing with these refuges quite consistently for the last number of months. I'm finding that it's a very beautiful practice. So very fundamental core to our practice is what is called taking refuge. Refuge in the Buddha, refuge in the Dharma, refuge in the Sangha. And just the thought, when I have the thought to take refuge, right in that, my whole self relaxes. My whole heart relaxes. This actual thing we do, it is not conceptual, that we find places in our lives that are dependable and safe and comfortable, a place that we go for refuge. And in our practice, taking refuge means to align ourselves, to set our hearts on a path, to commit ourselves to this practice that we do together. So when I was here last time, and we talked about refuge in the Buddha, we explored it as refuge in the cultivation of faith. And we won't go through the whole thing, but I want to give you a little recap on that. So oftentimes when we take refuge in the Buddha, we might take refuge in the actual historical figure of the Buddha himself because of what he represents and what he taught and what we've learned from his existence so long ago that is still so relevant to us now. Perhaps taking refuge in the Buddha is more of a metaphorical figure of the Buddha, the one who knows, the one who is the wisdom leader. It could be an elder, a mentor. It can be the Dalai Lama. It can be a being you've never met. It can be a being who represents for us this quality of security and knowing and dependability. sorry about that. But I like to think of taking refuge in the Buddha as refuge in our own inner knowing. What we have learned over time about our own selves, that we start to become our own true north. This is refuge in our wisdom. And that's how I think of refuge in the Buddha, is this place in us that actually knows. And this comes about from a cultivation of sadha, S-A-D-H-A, or faith in Buddhist practice. And this is also thought of as confidence or trust. How do we keep coming back to what we know, what we learn, and we trust that? And so confidence and trust build on themselves, right? That the more we do something and we see that it works and it's supportive and it's helpful, the more confidence we have in that, the more we can trust it, the more we rely on it, the more we can take refuge in it because it's real and it's reliable. And this leads us into this quality of wisdom that we all have, that our practice helps us reacquaint ourselves with our own wisdom. And there's some compass questions I like that we brought in last time, which is, how do we know what we know? It's a good question, you know. How do we know what we know? And then how do we trust what we know? And can we let that guide us? So those are the questions that we looked at last time around refuge in the Buddha. And we can really take those questions apart. And we can use them as reflections, we can use them as deeper understandings, or we can really make it simple. And Venerable Bhikkhu Bodhi says, just do two things, begin and keep going. Isn't that nice? Maybe we don't have to get so hyper-analytical. Just begin and keep going. When you find what is working, just do it. Just keep at it. Keep working it. When you find what doesn't work, stop doing it. So I know for myself, sometimes I can get a little too hyper-analytical on this, and it's easier on me to just lighten up and just keep going. Just keep practicing. Just keep exploring this. I don't have to figure out all the whys and what's happening. I know what's happening is I feel better. I behave a little bit better. I'm less reactive. I'm more loving. I have more capacity. That's really what is coming out of this. So that's what we did at the end of September. And now I want to take a dive, an exploration into this next of this triple gem of Buddha Dharma Sangha, and look at refuge in the Dharma. So when we think of the Dharma, what is the Dharma? It's what the Buddha taught, the teachings of the Buddha. It's also defined as the truth, reality, the nature of things, how things are. What we learn from our own direct experience. And so these kinds of things that we learn that are verifiable, that happen over and over again, that become refuge for us, this is taking refuge in the Dharma. But one of the most important teachings, I think, that the Buddha gave us is the teaching that is called the Kalama Sutta. And this is the sutta in which he said, don't believe me, find out for yourself based on your own direct experience. Does this work or does it not work? And what an amazing teaching to give, because he said, if it didn't work, I wouldn't ask you to do it. And it's an amazing teaching to say to anybody, find out for yourself. And when you do, follow what works and drop what doesn't work. Because any time someone we respect or revere or honor has that kind of confidence in us to say, you can do this. Practice with it. Try it out. See what works. And if you find that it supports you, keep doing it. When you find things that don't support you, stop doing it. So we come back to that teaching over and over again through this practice of taking refuge, because ultimately we're taking refuge in our own good hearts. Over and over again, we come back to that. Here's the sutta specifically. Let me read it to you. It's nice to be reminded of it. It is indeed fitting to be uncertain. It's fitting to doubt. For in situations of uncertainty, doubts surely arise. You should decide not by what you have heard, not by following convention, not by assuming it is so, not by relying on the texts, not because of reasoning, not because of logic, not by thinking about explanations, not by acquiescing to the views that you prefer, not because it appears likely, and certainly not out of respect for a teacher. You know, how many times have we held a teacher up on a pedestal and then something happens and that pedestal breaks? It can crush our hearts. So we really want to cultivate this within, so it really comes from our direct experience. And then the Buddha goes on to say, when you know for yourselves that greed, ill will, and delusion are unhealthy and inclined towards harm and suffering, then reject them. When you know for yourselves that non-greed, non-ill will, non-delusion are healthy and inclined towards welfare and happiness, then stay with them. This is our practice, right? To be able to discern the difference. And greed, ill will, or ignorance, delusion, confusion, whatever word you want to use, they have their very obvious manifestations and then the really subtle ones. The obvious ones are easy. The subtle ones are not easy. How does ill will reside in our hearts? What are the ways we reject ourselves or others that we're not even realizing that we're doing that? So this is why this is a continual lifelong practice. I love that what the Buddha is basically saying is don't drink the Kool-Aid, right? Don't drink this Kool-Aid. Find out for yourself and take refuge in your direct actual experience. Don't kid yourself. You know, let's take our own blinders off. Hard to do. And this is why sitting and meditation is so vital to the development of this clarity and lack of confusion. The other teaching the Buddha gave, he said, what when I do it will be for my long-term welfare and happiness? That's a great compass question. What when I do it is for my long-term welfare and happiness? This doesn't mean that we don't seek out short-term gratification. I mean, get the ice cream cone. It's not that big of a deal. But keep the long view in mind. So what I want to talk about is how. What is the how of taking refuge in the Dharma? It sounds good, doesn't it? Take refuge in your own direct experience. And this is, I think, what he's pointing to in the sutta, that don't just follow explanations. We have to figure out how we are going to be with our lives as they are. So the great, beloved Pema Chodron, American Buddhist nun, she gives us a beautiful framework on the how of taking refuge, how to live our lives. She says, first off, be fully present. You can check out the turkey who's looking in the window. Be fully present. Do you feel a little joy come up? Isn't that great? It's just wonderful. Okay, so Pema says, be fully present. This means cultivate mindfulness of everything. The body, the heart, the mind, internally and externally. Watch how our filters, our conditioning, how they influence us. Try not to cause harm. This is be fully present. Get to know yourself internally. See how you are with others and don't cause harm. We could talk about be fully present for a very long time. Mindfulness of the body, mindfulness of being aware of pleasant and unpleasant, mindfulness of thoughts and emotions, but I'm giving you a little summary. The second part of this is to feel your heart. Become aware of how loving kindness, compassion, empathy, joy, fear, sadness, resentment, anger, what is there? This is feel your heart. This is part of becoming fully present. And the other thing Pema says is help others. Because we know when we help others, it stimulates something in our own hearts. The quickest way to feeling better is to be of service so often. So we feel our heart, tap into that, and help others. And the third aspect of how do we do this life, how do we take refuge in the Dharma and come close to the Dharma, is to engage the next moment without an agenda. This is not easy, is it? We have agendas, we have expectations, we have goals, but how can we actually embrace the world just as it is, the way we recognize the dry earth? And it's frightening, and it's sad, and it's scary. Can we feel that? Does it stimulate us in us that piece of how can I help? How can I not cause further harm? So when you start looking around, we recognize our friends who are ill. The very tangible difficulties of living this life that we all know intimately through our own lives and the lives of others. It invites us into be fully present. Feel your heart. And engage this moment just as it is without having it to be this way or that way, because how it is like this. That is a profound surrender. It is not relinquishing. When I say surrender, what I mean by that is not resignation at all. It is an active engagement in how things are. A profound surrender is, wow, it's really like this. This is how the earth is now. This is how my life is now. In the Dhammapada, the Buddha said, happiness is contentment with whatever there is. Happiness is contentment with whatever there is. That's hard. And that was a different time that he said that. That was 2,600 years ago. And sometimes when I read these teachings, I think, yeah, if you only knew. Anybody agree? Yeah, if you only knew. But, you know, what were the conditions then that he was even saying then? Engage the next moment as it is. Embrace the world as it is. Happiness is contentment with whatever there is. What that means for me when I read this and I practice with that is, we're not talking about Hallmark happiness, are we? Hardly. We're not talking about that. We are talking about our capacity to say, yeah, it is like this. And it doesn't have to mean that I can't function. It means, all right, this is what we've got to deal with. My fundamental, let's use contentment or happiness, does not need to be destroyed because there are really difficult issues that we are facing. And through our practice, what we are developing is this resiliency. Every single time we turn towards what is difficult, and we work with, how am I going to be with this? And we don't hide. We don't put our head under the pillow. But we actually turn towards the difficulty and bring our hearts to this. That is strengthening our courage. That is really, really strengthening us. So happiness is contentment with whatever there is. I woke up again today. We all woke up again today, and we got to come here to be with each other, to explore this practice within the difficulties of our lives. And we all have them. There's no doubt. This is a profound turning towards whatever it is. All right, so get your hand out. So I came across this a couple of years ago, and as I was preparing to come here today, I was going through my archives. And you know, the coolest thing about Word or any of these programs that we use, if you keep track of what you've written, you can search by a word. And it's amazing. You know, I think I searched refuge in the Dharma, and like all these documents came up that I've saved over the years. Any single time I wrote that, Word brings it up and shows me what I've talked about or written about in previous times. It's just a brilliant tool. And I'd forgotten about the Monk's Manifesto, and it came up, and I thought, I really want to bring this in. So Christine Waltner's Paintner, she is the abbess of an online abbey called the Abbey of the Arts. It's in Ireland, and it's a monastery without walls that is non-denominational, although I do think that it's rooted in Christian tradition. It's very Irish, but she's very serious about making contemplative practice available for anybody around the world who is interested. And she has a particular interest in tapping into our creative selves. So expression of music and art and dance, and she's also devoted to the earth. So I found this and I love it. And I want to read it to you, and then as we read through it, we'll come back, and I'd love to know for you what stands out. What is, like, of these seven commitments, what do you relate to? So I'll just read it out loud and follow along. I commit to finding moments each day for silence and solitude to make space for another voice to be heard, and to resist a culture of noise and constant stimulation. Number two, I commit to radical acts of hospitality by welcoming the stranger both without and within. I recognize that when I make space inside my heart for the unclaimed parts of myself, I cultivate compassion and the ability to accept those places in others. Three, I commit to cultivating community by finding kindred spirits along the path, soul friends with whom I can share my deepest longings, and mentors who can offer guidance and wisdom for the journey. Four, I commit to cultivating awareness of my kinship with creation and a healthy asceticism by discerning my use of energy and things, letting go of what does not help to nurture and flourish. Does not help nature to flourish. Number five, I commit to bringing myself fully present to the work I do, whether paid or unpaid, holding a heart of gratitude for the ability to express my gifts in the world in meaningful ways. Number six, I commit to rhythms of rest and renewal through the regular practice of Sabbath and resist a culture of busyness that measures my worth by what I do. And number seven, I commit to a lifetime of ongoing transformation, recognizing that I am always on a journey with both gifts and limitations. Isn't that beautiful? So let's take this apart. What resonated for you? Was there one in here that you said, I want to talk about that? And we've got a mic. Diane, right up front. Yeah, yeah.
Number two, especially the part.
Yeah, yeah. Let's, yes. And it'll get on the tape so people listening can hear. Thank you.
Number two resonated with me.
It's not on. Oh, we'll try again.
Hello?
There you go. Yeah, there's on now. Right in front of your mouth.
Hello? Okay.
No?
No.
Okay, just talk loudly.
Okay.
This one's not working. Is this one working?
I'll do my best. So the second part about finding the places in yourself, and what it made me think about is kind of something you started with. which was the ideas of curiosity. And so being open and curious to yourself that could be old and lost a voice or new. So, yeah, number two really hit.
Yeah, thank you. So let's read that again. I commit to radical acts of hospitality by welcoming the stranger both without and within. I recognize that when I make space inside my heart for the unclaimed parts of myself, I cultivate compassion and the ability to accept those places in others. Is this taking refuge in the Buddha? Do you think? I wonder if it is. There are many ways to think about this. But this piece, thank you, Diane. Like, what are those places in us that we know? What are these places we don't know? And can we allow that? This is this concept of radical hospitality that I think is so vital to what we are talking about here. Radical hospitality. Can I befriend my own mind and heart, body and life? Can I make that a hospitable place? And when we talk about radical here, we are not talking about extremist at all. We are talking about a different definition of radical as from the root, complete. Complete hospitality towards ourselves. This is really vital, and this is what our practice is bringing us into. This is not a self-improvement project, our practice of mindful awareness. This is the process of self-acceptance, self-love. That's what we're really up to, because when we do that, we can offer that to others. The judgmental mind quiets down. The comparing mind, the inner critic mind. We're not asking to not be discerning. We need our wisdom. But when we make our lives a hospitable place for ourselves, it changes us completely. What else?
You're working now.
Okay, great. Thank you.
The one that resonated with me was number seven, the lifetime of ongoing transformation. It's something that I've always been aware of. In fact, I wrote it into my wedding vows that I said to my husband to encourage his growth and fulfillment through all the changes of our lives. That was part of my vows. But it has a different meaning for me now than it does then. And what struck me was this word, both gifts and limitations. I'm 72 years old now. My life is, you know, knock wood, not over yet, at least for today. And my journey's not over. The time for change is not over. And a lot of the changes that I'm dealing with now have to do with the limitations that come with age. And it's just another kind of transformation. So gratitude for both the gifts and the limitations.
Yeah, I'm so glad that you said that. Because when we acknowledge our limitations, we're acknowledging our humanity, right? And at younger ages, we may push that away. Or we may beat ourselves up for having a limitation, even if we're 20 years old. Like, right? Like, I could not get geometry, no matter what, right? But that's right. This commitment to ongoing transformation means that we can keep learning and growing, no matter what. That, too, is taking refuge in the Dharma. Because this is an experience, a direct experience of what is. Thank you. Who else? Yes.
What struck me was actually something from five in juxtaposition to something from six of bringing myself fully present to the work I do, whether paid or unpaid, but then in six, not measuring by my worth by what I do.
Isn't that something? Yeah, so what do you think?
I think that the second part is something that I'm inclined to, is to measure my worth by what I do. Mm-hmm. And to be able to fully bring yourself to what you're doing without the second part would be very nice.
And I think that what that's pointing to, I'm glad you brought this up, is an exploration of attachment versus commitment. So, you know, so often we work in, certainly through the lens of our practice, we hear over and over again about non-attachment, non-attachment, non-attachment. Well, what does that really mean? And that's something that we could talk a very long time about. It doesn't mean we don't care about what we're doing. So we can be committed to something that is dear to our hearts. And that's the work that we do. But we do it knowing we don't know the outcome of what's going to be. We have hopes and dreams for the outcome, but it's not all of who we are. And I think that where in number 6, where it says, to resist a culture of busyness that measures my worth by what I do. How many deals did you do today? You know, or whatever the thing is. That's not a measure of who we are. It's a reflection of the work we did, but there's so much more to us than that task. So can we be engaged with our gifts, what we are really good at, in meaningful ways, and we commit to that, but we also know there's more. Did you want to say more about it?
I guess it also strikes me as being a process of letting go.
Yeah.
To fully commit to what you do and then let it go.
That's right.
Without seeing, you know, to see but not be concerned about what the, you know, is that judged as good? Is that judged mm-hmm. as bad? Mm-hmm. Should I have done more? Could I, you know.
And we are all plagued by that at times.
Right.
Because we have our conditioning, because we have our own inner voice on this. But it's such an important thing to be engaged in work that is meaningful to us. Isn't that the best? When you are involved in something that really matters to you, that's a place of almost untapped energy. You know, when we are, like, we can just keep doing that thing that is meaningful to us. But when we're involved in something that isn't important to us, it becomes laborious. And so we do want to have that awareness of, what are my gifts? Where are my natural talents? Can I tap into that? And then the work of the renunciation of all the external judgments about, did I do enough? The internal and external judgments about, did I do enough? And we live in a culture that does judge us on, does place our worth by what we are doing. But that's our internal work. That's the internal process to let that go and to know deeply we are doing good work and we're doing what we can. That's all that's required of us, is to do what we can, to be connected, and to know when we've tipped over the edge to, I actually can't do that. Is that helpful? Anybody else? Yes, Bill.
I couldn't help but get past number 1. I was late this morning. There was an accident on the bridge coming in, and I have NPR on, so I get the first 45 minutes of the Democratic presentation of the hearing this morning, and I go, "Oh Christ, this is, I got to get here now." I really need to get here now because I couldn't turn the radio off.
Right. Anybody else? Yeah. Yeah.
Before I retired, silence and solitude was something I avoided because my biggest problem is myself. That's who I am. I heard Lucy tell Linus that one day. And to make space for another voice, the only voice that was out there in the courtroom was mine. Mm-hmm. And being an adrenaline junkie, constant stimulation was my drug of choice. And since I've retired, I now can, I don't do that much anymore. And it's hard not to do that in this society, especially in today's environment. And still think you're still being aware of what's going on in the world out there. And now I get to the point where I think the less I know about it, the better off it is. It's really okay. It doesn't have a major impact on my life anymore.
So that is an incredibly important perspective, isn't it? To know that the peace of your own mind, P-E-A-C-E, the peace of mind we get from periods of silence and solitude is so critical for our well-being, and to know when we turn the radio off. Because when we stop absorbing what isn't good for us, the aspects of greed, ill will, ignorance, because we think we need to know more, but we actually have the courage to say, wait a minute, is this supporting my well-being? And we say, no, actually, this is degrading my heart and my mind, and my anxiety and stress is going way up. And we can trust that we are going to know what we need to know, aren't we? But we don't have to have the blow-by-blow. That's my experience. I don't need the blow-by-blow. It's not supporting my well-being. We know we're in a heap of trouble. Okay, we know that. So I think that that's right. Finding moments each day of silence and solitude to make space for this voice that can come up to say, what do I need? What supports me? So I'm going to jump a little bit ahead on this. From this piece of radical hospitality, which that is, to know what we need and to know what we don't need and have the courage to let go of what doesn't support us. That leads us into what I think of as radical integrity. Radical integrity. So when we think, again, radical, not extremist, but whole, from the root, complete, when we recognize the direct connection between what we think and what we do, and what we experience and what we feel, we start connecting the dots of what holds us together. And so the word integrity, I'm talking about it from the place of like integra, skin, that which holds things together. And so we can think of radical integrity. What is it that holds your life together, that supports you? It's your ethical life. It's your commitment to being present with your life, the commitment to cultivating the heart of kindness, compassion, and not harming others. We can rely on our integrity that we cultivate deeper and deeper and deeper through this practice, through the practice of radical hospitality, which is the entire monk's manifesto. It leads us to this reality of living in radical integrity. And we're not always going to get it right. Of course we're not. We're human. But when we blow it, we say, yeah, we make amends. We see those places that we can shift. So we need, number one, we need these times of quiet so we can reflect. We get a larger perspective when we take time for quiet. You know, we can look at, what was my day like? What are my habitual routines? Do we intentionally take time for silence? Or does it happen spontaneously? And if it happens spontaneously, cool. Notice it. Notice that that is just starting to happen. And take time intentionally. Even if it's 5 minutes, go sit quietly somewhere. And just feel. Give yourself that break. And what about solitude? What is our relationship to solitude? Does it make us uncomfortable to be alone? Or to be in a room silently with others? Is that too much solitude? Or to go in a room by yourself? Is it hard to be alone? So for some it is. And that's a true thing. Can we let go of the constant external stimulation so we can actually nurture who we are? Aya Khema, she was a German-born Buddhist teacher. She, to my knowledge, she was actually the first Western woman to become an ordained Theravadan Buddhist nun. And she talks about the need for solitude of the body and solitude of the mind. And she says everybody should have occasion each day to be on his or her own physically for some time so that we can really feel alone, totally by ourselves. We go away and sit by ourselves in a room or a cave and tell the people we're living with that we want to be left alone. And can, when we, if we do that, can the person we're living with respect that and give us that? That it's not about them. It's not a rejection of anybody else. It's about, I just need to go hang out with myself a little bit. And I think we all know that. You know, sometimes we can get in the car and nobody else is there. I mean, that's my experience. Like, I kind of like that alone time. Or other kinds of places that we find ourselves alone, that it feels freeing. And we need that. Solitude of the mind. Time for self-inquiry. This is an essential practice. And we are doing this. That's why we're all here. This is the solitude of the mind. Aya Khema says, if there's a fog in one's mind, all we need is a searchlight to penetrate it. The searchlight is the meditation. So we might sit down and have our minds be all over the place or foggy or sleepy, but when we focus right on the breath or focus on the body or perhaps metta, that is focusing the light. And it helps the fog lift. So I commit to finding moments each day for silence and solitude, to make space for another voice to be heard. And then when it says, and to resist a culture of noise and constant stimulation, this actually takes us into the precepts. The precepts that say, I undertake a training to not engage in that which causes heedlessness of the mind, to actually connect. What is it that we consume that creates a foggy mind? It's not just drugs and alcohol. It's the media. It's whatever we are consuming that has the ability to take us out of this presence of mind. So I hope you take this with you and use it for a reflection practice. Just explore, how do these different aspects of commitments land for you? Rumi says, which is worth more, a crowd of thousands or your own genuine solitude, freedom, or power over an entire nation? A little while alone in your room will prove more valuable than anything else that could ever be given to you. A little while in your own room, alone in your own room, will prove more valuable than anything else that could ever be given you. So do that. You know, find this time. And what happens out of that is we are taking refuge in the Dharma. Yeah, Mark. Thanks, Anne.
I found for myself that that time can happen a lot of times in a day, and it can happen in a breath. It, you know, I don't need to, I mean, I have a practice, I sit, but during the day, I may just get into my car and take a couple of breaths before I start moving. And someone said something about a perfect moment, but in a moment, a lot can happen, and in a breath, a lot can happen. So I guess what I'm thinking of is, if you don't have 5 minutes, you might have a breath.
thank you. You're absolutely right. That it doesn't have to be a big, exalted thing. It is the opportunity to become present right here, come right now. Because there's so much that happens in one inhale and one exhale. I completely agree with you. So we don't have to put a lot of pressure on ourselves necessarily to go sit quietly in a room, even though it's beautiful and it's wonderful. So here's a practice for that. This is called the STOP practice, and some of you may know it. It's an acronym, STOP. And you can do this on one breath cycle. S is for stop, literally, stop. T, take a breath, tune in. O, open, observe. P, pause or proceed, whichever you need. So on the inhale, stop, take a breath. On the exhale, open and proceed. Just like that, right? So take that stop practice. Stop, tune in and take a breath. Open, observe. Ooh, I'm not ready to proceed. I better park it. Right? We check in with ourselves. So this is another way. Thank you for bringing that in, Mark, that we can cultivate that place in us that's a little quieter, that is actually always there. This is this quality of awareness that is always there that we can tap into. So this is another way. This, all of this that we're talking about is taking refuge in the Dharma. How things are. Being willing to turn towards how things are. The nature of things. The truth of impermanence. Everything is always changing. Always in the process of changing. Life is difficult for all of us. Period. And so much of what happens happens because other things happen. This is the truth. This is the Dharma. This is a poem I want to read to you from William Stafford. It's called The Way It Is, the Dharma, The Way It Is. There's a thread you follow. It goes among things that change, but it doesn't change. People wonder about what you're pursuing. You have to explain about the thread, but it's hard for others to see. While you hold it, you can't get lost. Tragedies happen, people get hurt or die, and you suffer and get old. Nothing you do can stop time's unfolding. You don't ever let go of the thread. This is our refuge in the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha. This is the thread that holds us. Are there any questions, more comments? So I want to do one more thing and just shift just briefly into what is refuge in the Sangha. This experience that we have when we come together, Sangha, our spiritual communities, or I like to think of, when I say spiritual, I'm thinking about what moves my heart, what is meaningful to me. Spiritual practice is that which brings us into what is important to us. What moves us. So refuge in the Sangha is just what we're doing here. That when Bill said, oh God, I got to get there. You know, knowing that when we walk into this time together, there's something that happens for us that's very comforting and very soothing. And we need each other. We need each other to help us each support our own practices because we cannot practice alone. I don't think. I mean, yes, we can all practice in a breath and in the car and in our rooms, but we do need each other to sustain the depth of practice, to be able to show up together and say something joyful that happened or something difficult that happened, the way we share each other's joys and sorrows. We need that. And we can depend on each other for that. Every time we show up, What a beautiful thing. What an amazing thing that we keep showing up to do this. And it doesn't have to be our spiritual communities per se, even though that is the intention of what Sangha means. It could be book club, it could be bike riding club, it can be cooking club, it can be anywhere where you go, where you get together with others of like mind and offer each other companionship. We are companioning and consoling, as Sylvia Boorstein says. I love that. One day she said, really, you know, the only thing we're doing here is companioning and consoling. And I thought, yeah, I want to be part of that. That's really true. So we're doing that. And at the bottom of your handout are some song lyrics that I'm going to play. I think Mary Ellen's going to come in and turn this on for us in a moment. And we can, yeah, that would be great. Yeah, thank you. And I think that this is an expression, you'll see, it's an expression of refuge and an expression of Sangha. And I can't stop listening to it. I was actually woke up. You know, when the song gets stuck in your mind for days, it's been like that. So I thought, okay, I'm bringing it in because we need to do that. Anything else while we wait for Mary Ellen that you'd like to bring in? Were there other pieces of today that you either have a question about or want to add? It comes from a group called Mamuse, two women, M-A-M-U-S-E. They might be Bay Area women. And I first learned about them listening to Pandora, actually. And I loved it and then pursued it. And then I just heard it again recently.
It won't hook up to Bluetooth.
Oh, bummer. Is the Bluetooth, do you have the settings on Bluetooth?
It should automatically hook up. That was that noise that you heard.
Can we hold the mic on it?
Yeah, I'm going to try it with that.
Okay, good, thanks. Because it's worth it. It's really beautiful. Oh, it came off of here? Oh, that's okay.
There we go.
Oh, that's the wrong song. Let's see. Let me get the right one. Okay, ready?
By the company we keep, by the ones who circle round to tend these fires. We shall be known by the ones who sow and reap the seeds of change alive from deep within the earth. It is time now. It is time now that we thrive. It is time we lead ourselves into the turning, we shall learn to lead in love. In this great turning, we shall learn to lead in love. We shall be known by the company we keep, by the ones who circle round to tend these fires. We shall be known by the ones who sow and reap the seeds of change alive from deep within the earth. It is time now. It is time now that we thrive. It is time we lead ourselves into the well. It is time now. And what a time to be alive. love. We shall be known by the company we keep, by the ones who circle round to tend these fires. We shall be known by the ones who sow and reap the seeds of change alive from deep within the earth. It is time now. It is time now that we thrive. It is time we lead ourselves into the well. It is time now. And what a time to be alive. In this great turning we shall learn to lead in love. In this great turning we shall learn to lead in love. In this great turning we shall learn to lead in love. In this great turning we shall learn to lead in love.
Thank you, everybody. I hope you enjoyed that. Isn't it beautiful? So this is what we're doing, right? When we come into this deeper awareness of who we are and what we are and how we are, it leads us to taking really good care of ourselves and each other, this heart of love. Take good care. See you next time I'm here.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.